This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entek. In what has been dubbed the Bin Abdullah case, the Court of Appeal ruled in a landmark decision last month that an illegitimate Muslim child can carry the name of his father, contradicting two religious edicts or fatwas issued by the National Council of Islamic Affairs in 1981 and 2003. The fatwas state that illegitimate children should bear the patronym Bin Abdullah instead of his father's name. In this particular case, the child was conceived out of wedlock and was born less than 6 months after the date of his parents' marriage. Here with me to explain the significance of this is Nizam Bashir, a member of the parents' legal team who argued their case successfully at the Court of Appeal. Nizam Bashir, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you.
So your clients, the couple, both of whom are Muslims, were married in 2009. The child's birth came slightly under 6 months later and the birth was registered after 2 years. When did they realize that something was not right?
Well, I suppose they probably knew something was not right from the very beginning, in the sense that the child was not able to be registered in the name that they wanted. And probably that was heightened when they came across news reports on a forum that I took part in, talking about the issue, the policy that JPN had, where illegitimate children are concerned, in terms of upholding a fatwa which says that the children cannot be given the father's name, and the child will have to be registered with a Bin Abdullah. So I suppose from there they started to try and identify where I was from, and they made the trip from Johor. They came to Melaka, where I used to be practicing at. And, they were then redirected to come to KL, and that's how we met.
They were at the forum after they found out that the child can't take after the father's name.
No, they were not at the forum, but they just came across an article about the forum. Basically, at the forum, there were three speakers. I was one of the speakers. But there was the former Mufti of Perlis, Dr. Juanda Jaya, and also the Sharia High Court Judge of Terengganu, Dato' Ismail Yahya. And the common position of the three speakers essentially was the child should be able to be registered with the name, with the bin of the father's name.
When did the case begin?
I think the case began sometime in 2015. We filed a judicial review application at the Kuala Lumpur High Court, but we didn't succeed at the first stage. What we then did was we filed an appeal to the Court of Appeal, and we offered actually a number of options to the National Registration Department in terms of trying to resolve the dispute. One of which was actually, we even told the National Registration Department, look, we are quite happy to try and get the child's name registered even without the Bin Abdullah. So in other words, it's just the child's personal name. And we suggested that, essentially with a view of trying to accommodate the views of all parties. But even then, they refused. They said, no, the child has to be registered with the Bin Abdullah pursuant to the fatwa of the National Fatwa Committee. So we were then left in a quandary. We had no choice, and we decided to pursue the appeal. And the result is what you have read in the papers or heard about on the radio so far. In the sense that the child is able to be registered with a name where there is a bin with the father's name.
So at the center of the National Registration Department's case is they're basing it on two fatwas issued by the Fatwa Committee, as you mentioned, in 1981 and 2003. Can you briefly tell us what were the instructions contained in those two fatwas?
Well, the 1981 fatwa and the 2003 fatwa by the National Fatwa Committee shares a common thread. Essentially, both deal with the status of illegitimate children in terms of how one would be able to ascertain whether a child is illegitimate or otherwise. And this is contained specifically in the 2003 fatwa. So what the fatwa says essentially is a child is born out of wedlock or is illegitimate irrespective of whether the child was born as a consequence of rape or illicit sex, zina. And the child must have been born less than 6 months and 2 seconds, according to the Islamic calendar, from the date conjugal relations took place. So that's essentially the time frame and, you know, the type of relationship by which a child is born. Yeah, the 1981 fatwa and the 2003 fatwa then goes on to deal with the naming of an illegitimate child. And both essentially say that the surname of an illegitimate child must be Bin Abdullah. It cannot be, the paternity cannot be ascribed to the father. I mean, that's the substance of both the 1981 fatwa and the 2003 fatwa. And we took issue with the NRD upholding both fatwas when, you know, a child, an illegitimate child is to be registered, or even if the particulars of the legitimate child's name is to be corrected. Because as we saw it, both fatwas are decisions of the National Fatwa Committee. It's not law which they can lawfully take into account. And you know, that's why we filed the challenge.
How should we view a fatwa then if they are not the law?
Yeah, well, keep in mind firstly that the framework that we have for Islamic law in Malaysia, the legislative competence for any Islamic law is given to the states. So it is only the states that is empowered to enact Islamic law. And so you have within the respective state Islamic law enactments provisions for fatwas to be drawn up and gazetted. So once it's gazetted, it becomes law which Muslims have got to comply with. What makes it, I think, all the more interesting here is that you have fatwas of the National Fatwa Committee, which a federal agency is purporting to uphold and say, you know, that's something that they're entitled to do. But that's not actually how the legal framework is for any fatwa to be sort of upheld as law. As I said, gazetting is the main prerequisite, even for state fatwas. Yeah, but in this particular case, although we have, you know, the 1981 fatwa and the 2003 fatwa by the National Fatwa Committee, both those fatwas, at least where Johor is concerned, has not been gazetted. So, in other words, if it is not gazetted, it's not something that any Muslim is obliged to follow as a matter of law, yeah? So I accept the fact that in some states, like maybe in Selangor or in Malacca, those fatwas may have been gazetted. So the situation may be slightly different in those states. But certainly where Johor is concerned, it's not law. So the NRD is not entitled to treat it as law that they can essentially apply as a matter of policy in terms of the naming of a legitimate child.
Johor here is important because the couple resides in Johor.
The couples reside in Johor. The child was born in Johor. Yeah.
How is a fatwa gazetted into law? Is it via the state assemblies?
Well, there is a process that's laid out statutorily. To put it very simply, what happens is that there is a sort of a state or government gazette, and the fatwa in question has got to be go through the process of being advertised, so to speak, in the Gazette. And once that is done, by and large, it becomes law, and you know, it's something that, therefore, Muslims thereafter have to follow if it is a fatwa that is gazetted. It's a crime not to follow a fatwa. There's a statutory provision on that as well.
Is this practice common in other Muslim-majority country, the insistence on putting Bin Abdullah as the patronym to an illegitimate child?
Well, the issue of the naming of an illegitimate child is something that is present in Islamic jurisprudence. So any country that essentially looks at Islamic jurisprudence on the matter certainly would come across it, and, you know, if there is a system, if the legal system allows for Islamic law to be enforced in that particular country, I'm sure there must be some way to give recognition to that. But in India, you may find the practice. I mean, let's put it this way. Islam is diverse. You have a range of opinions even on this matter. On this issue, you have majority scholars taking one position, saying that you can't attribute the paternity of the father to the child, and you know essentially say that the child is to be named with the bin of the father's name. You have minority scholars saying that no, it's okay, you can, you know, you think about the fact that the child is innocent. Those are things that in other words, there's a range of views on this issue. So, you know, I think even if you go to other countries, you'll find that diversity even reflected in terms of how they apply that particular jurisprudence in whichever country.
Would you know whether the 1981 and 2003 fatwa, were they issued in response to something? I ask because I wonder whether it can be amended later, a fatwa that was issued.
I mean, a fatwa is an opinion that is pronounced by a scholar, depending on the facts that's placed before him. So certainly, you know, if new facts arise, the scenario is different for whatever reason. They can always revisit it. They can always reconsider their position. That's not a problem. And for that reason, in terms of traditional Islamic jurisprudence and thinking on what the effect of a fatwa is, it's actually not binding. There is a school of thought that actually takes the view it's only binding on the author of the fatwa. But on any other person, you know, you can look at the reasoning behind the fatwa, you can decide whether it applies to you or otherwise. Of course, the Malaysian position is slightly different. We have gone on to actually say that if there is a fatwa that is in force, if you don't follow it, or you take a position that's contradictory to it, you know, you could be subjected to criminal prosecution. So we have gone, I think, slightly over and above the call of duty.
Criminal prosecution, even though this is under the Sharia law?
Well, if a fatwa is gazetted, it becomes law. Yeah. So I'm just responding to your question as to, firstly, what is the effect of a fatwa under traditional Islamic jurisprudence vis-a-vis what the Malaysian legal position is.
I'm speaking today to Nizam Bashir, a lawyer who argued successfully at the landmark Bin Abdullah case at the Court of Appeal. Up next, I'll ask him what the significance of this ruling going forward. You're listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. My guest today is Nizam Bashir, a lawyer, and we're talking about the landmark ruling by the Court of Appeal on the Bin Abdullah case. Nizam, so you kind of give us an idea of what the issue at stake is from the other side, which is the National Registration Department, who were basing their actions on two fatwas released by the Fatwa Committee in 1981 and 2003. What were the arguments that you and your team made in response?
Well, the starting point was Section 13A sub 2 of the Birth and Deaths Registration Act 1957. That section simply provides that the surname of an illegitimate child essentially can be the surname of the father, i.e. the child is registered with the bin of the father's name, as long as, you know, the application for that registration is done by both the mother and father. So the father has got to consent to it. That's the starting point. And in the case that we argued, that was the case. The father was insistent that his name be registered with the child's name. So the child essentially would have a bin of the father's name. And that was the starting point. The section was very clear. As long as the father was happy to acknowledge that fact that he's the father of the child, he was happy to allow the child to be registered with his name. Section 13A sub 2 is clear. You must register with the name of the father.
It doesn't matter whether it's an adoptive father or birth father.
Section 13A is just quite simple. First thing is the child must be legitimate. Second thing is the father must acknowledge that he's the father of the child. And once that prerequisite is there, the National Registration Department must register the child with the surname i.e. in the Muslim child's name, with the bin of the father's name. So that was the starting point. Over and above section 13A sub 2, we also pointed out that the National Registration Department's policy of upholding the 1981 and the 2003 fatwa seemed a bit misplaced, in particular because both fatwas were not gazetted in Johor. So it's not a law that applies to any Muslim residing in Johor. And over and above the issue of the non-gazetting of the fatwas, we also pointed out that the relevant provisions of the Johor enactment on this issue did not quite regulate the situation of an illegitimate child who is born less than 6 months. There is a provision as to ascription of paternity where the child is born after 6 months, but it doesn't deal with the situation of a child that's born born less than 6 months. So those were, in brief, the arguments that we raised in opposition to the National Registration Department's arguments.
Does this ruling say anything about how cases like this would be treated in states that have gazetted the fatwa?
The court did not deal with that scenario. Nevertheless, the court did not deal with that scenario explicitly. Nevertheless, I think what we ought to extract from the Court of Appeals judgment is that Section 13A sub 2 is quite clear as to what the prerequisites are. And given that Section 13A2 merely requires that the father essentially consents to his name being given to the child, then I think the National Registration Department should certainly look at the section first and foremost before attempting to apply a policy, a blanket policy, which disregards the fact that there is differing views on this issue across Malaysia. Keeping in mind that, National Registration Department essentially is tasked with registering not just a child from a particular state, but, your task is, essentially across Malaysia. So I think it is more helpful to have a consistent policy, which has got to be based on, I think, the ruling that the Court of Appeal has given. But I can appreciate the fact that, they would find themselves in a somewhat of a difficult position because there is this differing views across the states. And I think we'll have to see how that debate plays out for those states which have gazetted the national fatwas deliberations and views on the matter.
Because the NRD is a federal agency, right? And the constitution is the supreme law of the land. If the states have gazetted the fatwas, they will be considered state laws. Wouldn't states' law be obliged to adhere or not contradict the constitution?
Well, there's a provision certainly in the federal constitution, Article 75, which essentially says when you have state laws conflicting with federal laws, federal law prevails. Yeah, and the only reason why I was prepared to take a rather tentative stand, despite my views on Article 75, which I think is frankly very clear, is you have you from the news reports subsequent to the Court of Appeals ruling. The grounds of judgments coming out. The National Registration Department was quite happy to issue a media statement on the matter, wherein they said that they were going to apply the High Court ruling on the issue in the interim. So I found that somewhat disconcerting because you essentially had the Court of Appeal saying that, nope, the High Court ruling is wrong. This is the law. So I'm interested to see, firstly, what is going to be their rationale moving forward.
Do especially, they have to provide one?
Well, I think so because, you in terms of numbers, I mean, let's just look past the law for the time being. I mean, legalities aside, you have about 300,000 illegitimate children being registered with the National Registration Department since 2010. I'm not sure what the breakdown is for Muslims, but the numbers are quite worrying. You know, it's going to impact, their policy on the matter is going to impact a huge number of people. you know, perhaps when they issued the media statement, they may not have been aware of Article 75, maybe, and perhaps they would be inclined to reconsider their position in light of the fact that Article 75 is there, and there is a construction now being given to Section 13A sub 2 that it also applies to Muslims.
So I've seen this word in news reports that if this continues, that the NRD's position, it could become a contempt of court. What does that mean?
You have a court of appeal judgment, you know, stating that this is the law on the matter. And they were parties to the proceedings, so the law impacts on their policy. Their policy essentially is, you know, the court of appeal is telling them that their policy of trying to give credence to the 2003 fatwa and the 1981 fatwa is wrong. So you then have them issuing a statement saying that, you know, in effect, we are not going to recognize the judgment that the Court of Appeal has given. Now, those are actions which they're not giving due respect to the court's judgment. And those are actions that can amount to contempt of court. What follows on when there is an act of contempt is potentially they can be subject to a number of orders by the court to ensure that they comply and give force to the judgment of the court. So, but what we have done in the interim, we have said that because they have made an application for leave to appeal to the federal court, we're going to allow that proceedings to play out first before we attempt to enforce the judgment of the Court of Appeal.
And a leave is, in other words, a permission to appeal this decision. And do we know if that leave has been granted?
No, the leave has yet to be heard. But in my view, if you were to look at the Court of Appeal judgment, in fact, there is no constitutional rights involved in terms of this particular issue. So all that really arises from the Court of Appeal judgment is not a point of law of public importance, because when you talk about application for leave at the federal court, the principle by which it operates upon is there must be a point of law of public importance for it to move from a leave stage to a substantive appeal.
What does that mean, point of law of public importance?
That the principles involved in the case requires clarification, because the point is quite novel. You know, it breaks new ground in some way, and the decision will impact on the public in many respects. And because of its novelty in particular, the court should allow full arguments to be made on the matter, yeah, the federal court in particular. But in our view, that does not exist for this case, because the section is very clear. The only principle really that is involved is principles as to how to interpret a statutory provision. Nothing more. There's no constitutional rights. There's no real novelty in terms of the issue. We are just drawing on principles which have been tried and tested over the years. So there's no need for the leave application to move on to a substantive hearing. So that's our position.
When making an appeal like this, is it incumbent upon the party to make a different argument at the next level of the court? Or can they just refine the argument that they presented at the Court of Appeal?
They would have to provide questions of law to the federal court for the court to grant the leave application. Yeah. As I said, I personally don't think that there's any need for it to move past leave stage, because the principles that we are dealing with are actually tried and tested over the years. There's nothing really new. There is no prior decision on Section 13A sub 2 as well in Malaysia. So there's no conflict between two decisions of the Court of Appeal for that matter. So for that reason, there does not need to be any substantive hearing on the matter.
So while we wait for that, I assume the name of the child has not been changed to reflect the father's name?
For the time being, as I said, we are just letting the leave application be heard first. Once that is dealt with, then we will look at the matter again.
Did the fact that the birth was only registered 2 years later complicate things?
I wasn't involved, actually, at that stage. That was something that the parents had to deal with. But I don't think there was any problems, really, in terms of registering the birth of the child. And in fact, in terms of the provisions do allow it, except that the process is slightly different.
Let's take a hypothetical situation where the stay is refused. Would the 300,000 illegitimate children that has been born since 2010, will the Muslim children, will they be able to change their name to reflect their father's name?
Okay. There have been already one application for stay at the Court of Appeal. I think that was dealt with and heard either a week or two ago. It was disposed and dismissed by the Court of Appeal. Any parent who has a child in that particular position, they would be able to, you know, go to the nearest National Registration Department and really ask them to comply with the law. Okay? So we'll have to wait and see whether the department does deal with it in accordance with law.
What is the naming convention if you are a Muslim in Malaysia? Would the bin or a binti always be there?
It depends on, I think, who you speak to. I know that as a matter of fact, for a certain time period, the National Registration Department was prepared to allow Muslim children to be registered without a bin. I even have some personal friends whose children have been registered in that way. Whether that is something that they're doing now, I'm not sure. But in terms of religion, I don't think there's any real requirement that there is bin for a Muslim child.
Does it differ much for converts into the religion?
There is, I think, a policy that the National Registration Department have where converts are encouraged to have a bin Abdullah to their name. But some converts in particular take issue with it. I know, as a matter of fact, Chinese Muslim converts in particular, they have always been very keen to ensure that they don't have a bin Abdullah, because what matters to them, of course, is the fact that they are Muslims and also that they are able to retain the family name. The family name meaning to say the first name, because for Chinese, you know, that carries on over the generations. And they believe that would be more consistent with their views on the issue.
Just to go back a little bit then, on this requirement to name a child bin Abdullah, what is the reason behind this? What's the meaning of bin Abdullah?
Well, bin Abdullah basically means son of a servant of God. Yeah, Abdul basically means servant, and Allah means God. So Abdullah means servant of God. And I think that particular usage of bin Abdullah probably came about as a consequence of children who could not have paternity ascribed to their biological father because of the way that they have been conceived and born. So scholars essentially said that, you know, paternity of an illegitimate child cannot be ascribed to his or her biological father. So these children essentially could not have a bin or binti of their father's name. And it became a source of ridicule historically. Yeah. So the usage of the patronymic Abdullah or Asma'ul Husna, I think, was conceived really as a means to save them from being ridiculed. Okay, that's the historical position. Of course, over the years, I think we have grown to be a bit savvy in terms of how we register the birth of children, and those who deal with the registration of children, those who come face to face with children who have birth certificate is having a Bin Abdullah when the father's name is some other name on the birth certificate, they know the status of the child. And in some instances, the birth certificate even has a Section 13 endorsement at the bottom. So what became, I think, the means to save these children from being ridiculed has now become, I think, the means of the children being ridiculed. So I think it's timely that we revisit the matter and reconsider purely in terms of how we, the name of these children are being registered. Nothing beyond that. To my mind, really, the implication of the Court of Appeals judgment, it actually does not have any effect in terms of inheritance, at least for the time being. It doesn't have any effect in terms of, marital rights, etc., in terms of whether the child can be given away by the biological father or otherwise. I think for the time being, it's purely a naming issue that was dealt with. That's it.
Can you maybe elaborate on why it doesn't affect? Because that's what the Sharia Lawyers Association of Malaysia has come out and say, that it will impact inheritance and marriage laws.
Well, I think they are being a bit alarmist about the whole thing, because the argument was very precise. It purely related to a section of the Birth and Deaths Registration Act. No arguments were placed about the rights that that particular child will have beyond his ability to be registered with that name. That's it. So I really can't see the Court of Appeal judgment, at least that particular Court of Appeal judgment, having an impact beyond that. So I don't know where this Sharia Lawyers Association gentlemen have come up, or they are taking their views from what part of the judgment. I don't see that judgment anyway.
Another opposing view comes from lawyer Aidil Khalid, who wrote in an op-ed that the Birth and Death Registration Act, the wording or language used on it is surname, which does not conform to the Muslims' practice of naming a child after the father's first name, which is patronymic. Your thoughts?
I've not seen his op-ed, so I'm not sure what he means by it. But a Muslim's practice of naming a child is generally as follows. There is the personal name, for example, Ali. There is the connector, Bin, meaning son of. There's the patronymic surname, Ahmad, where Ahmad is the father. So the name of the child in full, therefore, would be Ali bin Ahmad. A patronymic surname simply means a name derived from an ancestor or the father. And in the case of how Malaysian Muslim children are named, the patronym would always be the father. So within that particular family, all the children in that family will be registered with the patronym of the father. So the next generation, of course, that doesn't necessarily hold true, meaning to say that the child of that particular family, let's say that the child is the father in the subsequent marriage, the registration would be only after the child in question.
If I can assume what this lawyer's position is that it's not the same as maybe the Western naming convention of the family name being retained throughout the generations. And I think this person was questioning the intention of the meaning behind surname, that it's more in line with that tradition where the surname is kept throughout the tradition instead of the father's first name.
I think there is a variation certainly as to how surnames are used depending on the region that you come from. There is, of course, the Anglo-Saxon usage of or traditions where a surname is concerned, where you have a surname carrying across multiple generations, okay? Certainly in terms of where Asia is concerned, the tradition in terms of surname is a patronymic surname for Muslims. You certainly have communities in Malaysia who have a different tradition where surnames are concerned, but that's only applicable to that particular community. Certainly where, for example, the Portuguese people or the Portuguese community in Malacca. They have that in common with the sort of Anglo-Saxon tradition of having surnames carrying across multiple generations. So we recognize that there is this diversity in terms of how surnames are being used. But our view, and I think this is also supported by relevant sources on the matter, is where Malay Muslims or even Muslims in this region are concerned, they use a patronym in terms of how they name their children.
Going forward, to avoid this kind of, I don't know if collision is the right word, should civil laws be Sharia compliant?
Okay, I wouldn't look at it that way. It seems a little bit antagonistic. Civil law versus Sharia laws, almost. So, and one or the other must always be compliant with the other. I prefer to look at it this way. We have a constitution, okay? We have a scheme in place as to how our laws are supposed to operate. So all laws will just have to be mindful of that constitutional scheme and check itself from upsetting that scheme.
Nizam Bashir, thank you very much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.